You're doing a series of things. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
I don't actually have the time, but I put it aside.
All right, well, thank you.
Go ahead, shoot.
Okay. I'm speaking with Peter Bogdanovich, who's made in my estimation, a brilliant expansion of a documentary that he made back in 71, I believe. And it's called Directed by John Ford. And it, as I was just telling him before we began recording, that it's a really impressive and deeply touching emotional portrait of a director who imparts quite a lot of genuine feeling and compassion in his films. But he himself, when he was speaking to journalists, which was very infrequently when he was around, was the very antithesis of someone who was emotionally open. And yet Peter managed to give you a real sense of who John Ford was deep down. And I was just wondering, Peter, as an opener, if you could just tell us how you managed to get yourself into the circle where he would even speak to you back in 1970 or whenever it was.
Well, actually, it started earlier than that. It started in 1963 when I was writing for Esquire quite a bit. That was in Esquire's heyday. And I said I wanted to do a piece on John Ford. And the managing editor, Harold Hayes, was a little reluctant, but eventually agreed. And so I went to Monument Valley, where Ford was shooting the last film he shot there, Cheyenne Autumn.
Mm.
And I spent 3 weeks with him. And
why did he agree to see it? Didn't he pretty much rebuff all entreaties from persons such as yourself at that time? Wasn't that his rep?
Yeah, what happened was, I don't know how it happened, I don't know how it went down, but when I arrived in Monument Valley, I don't think he knew anything about it, because the unit publicist was horrified when he found out.
Okay.
He said, "Oh, no, Ford won't see anybody." I said, "Well, but you guys are paying for me to be here." "Well, no, he won't see anybody." And it took, Carol Baker was on the picture, and her husband, Jack Garfine, is the director. We had a mutual friend, and we met, and it was Jack Garfine, or Carol, I can't remember who actually told Ford that I was there. At which point Ford, for some reason, approved it and sat me next to him at dinner. And he liked me. He kind of, you know, was pretty nice to me for the whole 3 weeks. In fact, at one point, the producer wanted us to leave. I was there with my first wife, and wanted us to leave to make room for Life magazine, because it was a huge, picture, and they wanted to get publicity. And Ford refused to. They wanted me to give up the trailer that I was staying in and leave.
Mm.
I told Ford about it, saying goodbye, and he said, and he made such an issue out of it that they said I could stay as long as I wanted.
Ah. The footage that we're going to be seeing and directed by John Ford when it is shown on, by the way, on the Turner Classic Movies on November 7th, correct?
The first showing will be on November 7th. Okay. There's two showings that day, and then they're showing it again later in the month, and they're showing Ford films all every Tuesday, I think, for the whole month.
Okay. And by the way, Peter, while we're talking about it, when will the DVD be made available?
Sometime next year.
Not until 07, what, the spring or something?
Early,
or?
The early part of 07. I would say the spring, yeah.
Right. Okay. And are there extras, by the way, besides what the film...
No.
Okay. No commentary from you?
Well, we haven't done it yet. They may ask me. I doubt it, but we'll see.
Oh, okay. Because you feel the film pretty
That's
much...
That's Warner Home Video has the rights to that.
Okay.
I think the movie sort of says what I had in mind.
I think it does in a very superb way. I really
thank you.
The thing that
quite different from the 1971 version, and you have to understand. I got to know Ford in '63. Then the Esquire piece came out. There was some controversy about that between him and me, which was sort of funny.
He didn't like something. What was?
He didn't like anything, you know.
Oh.
But it worked out all right. And then I did a book about him, an interview book, which came out in '67. Still in print. And
is it just a Q&A thing?
Well, it's a little book, but right. there is the heart of it is a Q&A.
All right.
It's called John Ford, University of California Press. Mm-hmm. And then the AFI asked me to do a documentary, and so that was the next step. And by then, as I said, by then he knew me. We knew each other. He tolerated me. Mm-hmm. He, in his own way, he kind of liked me. And I'd met Wayne Stewart and Fonda by then, too, because I'd done a piece for Esquire on Jimmy Stewart. So I knew everybody. And that made it a lot easier when, you know, to get in, to have access to interviewing them.
Right. And the footage that we see of you speaking to him was actually shot in, what, 60?
I think it was probably 68.
All right.
Or 69.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to check.
Okay. The revelation to me, I was just so taken with the quality of the filming of the John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. I mean, it was go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it looked like it was shot on 35 with the best equipment. It's really wonderful. It's so vivid and sharp and just a really excellent. Most interview footage tends to be a little on the smaller, grainier 16 millimeter side, and I was just amazed how good it looked and how good it sounded.
Yeah, thank you. The interviews with Ford, Wayne, Stewart, and Fonda were all shot in 35 millimeter with a dolly and all sorts of things.
It was really
shot like a movie.
Yeah. That was really exceptional. I mean, wasn't that difficult for you at that point? I mean, wasn't that obviously much more expensive and so on?
Well, that never became an issue. That was just the way we were going to do it.
Okay. All right.
And I don't remember it being an issue.
Mm. You know, it's funny. I was thinking...
I was very supportive, and the only trouble is they ran out of money.
Right.
And so they couldn't pay for the clips. And so consequently, the first version of this, which was shown at some film festivals in 71, 72,
right.
Really was hardly seen by anybody,
mm-hmm.
which is why I always wanted to redo it. One of the reasons I always wanted to redo it, because it had virtually no distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of became a legendary film, as things become legendary when they're not able to be seen.
Right, yeah. You know, it's
funny. This version is, and first of all, I never liked the original version that much. I thought the interviews were good, and Orson's narration, I mean, he did the narration beautifully, but I didn't like what I had done around it, and it was, you know, so a lot of the stuff you see in there that's particularly moving, like the whole thing with Kate Hepburn and the spirituality section of the picture, none of that was in there.
I see.
And Harry Carey Jr. wasn't in there. Maureen O'Hara wasn't right. in there. None of those. None right. of the interviews with Clint Eastwood, Steven right. Spielberg, Marty Scorsese,
yeah.
Walter Hill, or myself. None of that was in there. All that's new.
Right. Right. It's very very. I mean, I don't know how to describe my reaction. But when he says to Hepburn during that audio portion, how he loves her.
Yes.
I felt that he was really saying that. He really meant it deep down. It was really sad.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
He was crazy about her.
I mean, all his life.
Ever since he met her on Mary of Scotland, and I think they fell in love, and I think he continued to love her the rest of his life, and I think she appreciated his esteem.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know. Everybody wants to know, of course, if it was carnal. I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
Whether they actually had a affair or not.
Right. You know, I was thinking about Ford during a moment in The Departed when Matt Damon is speaking to Claire Forlani, you know, the therapist. Have you seen The Departed?
Yeah, I'm dying to see it.
He says that, you know, that you're wasting your time trying to psychoanalyze a bunch of Mick detectives. There's nobody that's more impervious to psychoanalysis and emotional exposure than Irish guys. And I was just thinking that Ford probably took the cake on that.
Well, Ford, you know, a lot of people speculate that Ford was basically a softy who covered up his poetic side in private life with, you know, a gruff exterior.
Mm.
He could be very mean to people. He wasn't particularly mean to me. There were times when he would pick on me, but it was usually rather funny.
Mm.
And it
I could see that. That's what's so fascinating about those chats. I mean, the humiliation that Stewart describes, that Woody Strode remark.
Yes, it's very funny.
Perhaps I should say that, explain for those listening who haven't seen the film, which is that at one point John Ford asked Stewart during the making of, now I've forgotten the film.
It was Liberty Valance. Bannon shot Liberty Valance.
All right. And Stewart felt that a line or reading that Strode had given.
No, he didn't like the costume.
Didn't like the costume. It looked a little Uncle Remus-y to him.
Yes, and Ford went nuts.
And then maybe you could tell the rest.
Well, I mean, it's you have to see the movie, but yeah. I mean, he humiliated him in front of the crew and cast.
Right.
Of course, it's funny in the movie because Ford did the same thing to Wayne on Stagecoach.
Yeah.
Called the cast and crew together and humiliated him in front of everybody.
Right.
Ford tended to do that. It was a.
Right.
There's a story about that. He did that with a producer on The Informer.
Mm.
He brought the producer down. And he said, "I want to introduce everybody. Gather around, please."
Yeah.
Brought everybody together and said, "I want you to meet the producer. His name is Cliff Reed. Now, I want you to take a very good look at him because you will never see him again." So that was. I mean, Ford was. Mm. Legendary for being, you know, hard-nosed and difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it was a time when the studios were pretty strong, and I guess that's how he kept as much of his independence as possible.
Yeah.
I think Walter Hill in the movie, the director Walter Hill, makes a comment that comments that Ford once said. He had 1,000 fights with the studio, and he lost them all.
Mm.
And Walter says, and yet he made They Were Expendable, My Darling Clementine.
Mm.
And he mentioned 3 or 4 pictures and said, I'd like to lose a few like that.
Yeah. It's funny, all my life in watching his films, I've never gotten such consistent delight from his framings, from his visual eye, which is the... it's just such a. It's like taking a warm bath every time I see one of his films. Even you can completely divorce yourself if you can from what they're about and how they are emotionally and thematically, and just look at them. They're just magnificent.
Well, he had a great eye.
Yeah. And I love that line that I think is in your doc about how he. Spielberg. Yeah, young Spielberg being asked about the horizon line.
Yeah, that was an interesting story. Stephen told about his meeting with Ford, which I didn't know, and Stephen mentioned it in the interview. He just said, I met Ford, and I said, tell me. He said, you want to hear the story? I said, yeah, tell me the story.
Mm.
So he told it, and we used it. It was charming.
Yeah. The thing I was thinking about was I would just wish there was more to it in a way because there's so many great stories. I was thinking of that one. What made me fall in love with John Ford apart from his visual sense? That confrontation that I saw in another documentary about he and Cecil B. DeMille when he stood up to him in 19.
Yes, that was the famous McCarthy period, and when Ford got up, there was a big. To do at the Directors Guild, DeMille was trying to get everybody to sign loyalty oaths.
Yes, right. Everybody had to sign a loyalty oath to the maybe you could explain more in detail. I don't. There's some people that may not know about this.
Well, it's a long story, but to boil it down, it was during the sort of Hollywood communist witch hunt, and Joe Mankiewicz was the head of the guild, and. DeMille, who was the most powerful director in Hollywood, I mean, the most successful, and a few other directors were pushing to have loyalty oaths signed by all members of the guild, and Mankiewicz thought it was un-American and was against it. And, of course, they started calling him a pinko. Now, I got this story directly from Joe Mankiewicz and from somebody else who was there, Sam Fuller, that night, and... the story goes that it was a big meeting of the Directors Guild convened to argue this case out, and all the directors in town showed up, including Ford, who sat on the aisle with his shoelaces untied and said nothing. 3 hours while the argument went on, and evidently Manka, DeMille was very, very virulent and attacking Mankiewicz, calling him a pinko and all that stuff. And they had a court stenographer there, so that whenever anybody was recognized by the chair, they would have to stand up, say their name, identify themselves, and then say what they had to say so that the court stenographer could, who was talking. Well, this went on for about 3 or 4 hours, and everybody, Ford was the most respected director in the room, but he didn't say anything. After about 4 hours, he raised his hand, was recognized, and he stood up and said, "My name's Jack Ford. I make westerns." And he said, "Nobody in this room knows more what the American public wants than C.B. DeMille. He gives the public what they want, and he's very good at it." And he turned to DeMille and looked at him across the hall and said, "But I don't like you, C.B. And I don't like what you've been saying here tonight, and I move that we give Joe a vote of confidence. Let's all go home and get some sleep." And that's what happened.
He didn't say, "I never liked you"?
No, he said, "I don't like you, C.B.
Okay, all right.
Don't like what you've been saying here."
Right.
So that's the story, and it was an amazing moment. But that was very Ford.
Now,
a very Ford moment.
In addition to the... to the screening at the AFI Film Festival, directed by John Ford, you are going to be doing a live show at the Linwood Dunn Theater. Is it this next night? I don't have it in front of me. What?
It's on the 9th. The John Ford screening is at the Linwood Dunn Theater on the 7th, and my in-person sort of one-man show that's called Sacred Monsters, I'm doing that on the 9th.
Right. Now, could you run down the genesis of why you decided to... do a live show? It sounds fascinating as hell. I can't wait to see it. But
I've been doing it around the country, sort of versions of it, different versions of it with different clips and different anecdotes, but basically the same idea for about almost 10 years since the book Who the Devil Made It came out, my director's book, and then I had another book, Who the Hell's in It, a couple of years ago, and those two books are sort of the foundation of the talk, which is basically anecdotes illustrating the idea of personality, the personality of the director behind the camera, and the persona versus the personality of the actor in front of the camera. So it sounds more complicated than it is, and I basically tell a lot of anecdotes, and because I do impressions, people like it because I tell the stories and then, you know, tell what happened in the voice of the person I'm telling it about. So it's a lot of laughs.
I presume it has some anecdotes about hawks.
It's mainly Hitchcock, Cary Grant, John Ford, John Wayne, hawks, Orson Welles, Otto Preminger, Jimmy Stewart. But that's the
golden era guys mainly.
Oh, it's entirely that.
When you speak, I'm sure that you speak to people like me a lot. You speak to a lot of fans of John Ford. In my limited knowledge of the man and his work, and whenever I've spoken to people, he kind of breaks down into two camps. They're the ones that love his work from the time of the Lost Patrol or before, all the way to the end. And there are those who are more fans of the, up until basically the end of World War II, as they feel his golden, his real prime period, and they have a little bit of a problem with the growing Irish sentimentality and the kind of the way, you know, Indians are treated in some of his films. You know, the way he kind of got a little myopic, a little sort of unto himself more and more. You know, the more Monument Valley movies he made, the more it seemed like it was less of the world in the way that I, you know, like the Informer was, and How Green Was My Valley, and all the, and how The Grapes of Wrath, which I think is his masterpiece. How do you come down on that? What do you say to people who say they like the old Ford rather than less than the Monument Valley late 40s, 1950s Ford?
I don't know. I think that Ford got more and more personal, and I think the films, if you knew Leo, if you knew him, which I was privileged to know him for about 12 years, 10 years, I guess it was, I like the later work better. Yeah. I mean, not better, but I think his peak, his great period begins in 39. Mm. And I think it goes, you know, pretty much to the end of the 50s.
Yeah.
He didn't make great films every time out, but he every so often make a great one just to remind you he was brilliant. I mean, the run from 39 to 41 with Stagecoach, Drums Along the Mohawk, Young Mr. Lincoln, The Grapes of Wrath, The Long Voyage Home, How Green Was My Valley, that run is Stagecoach. That's an amazing run. And then he went to the war and came back and made two or three brilliant films right up one after the other. They were expendable. Ford Apache, My Darling Clementine, they're all brilliant and really good on every level. And then he made a few that weren't so hot, but I mean, you have to take into consideration The Quiet Man, The Searchers.
Yeah.
I think his films got more personal, and Rio Grande and She Wore Yellow Ribbon, those are all terrific. I actually think I return more often to the post-war films than I do to the pre-war films.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just to get off topic just for a second, Peter, can you tell us anything about how many episodes you're in the final eight of The Sopranos?
I don't know. I'm in one so far, and I'm told it's another one or two, so I'm not sure.
How far are they along at this point?
I think they're shooting the fifth episode, fifth of the eight.
As we speak?
I think so.
And
I haven't spoken to anybody for a couple of weeks, but as I remember, they're on the fifth.
But we are supposed to see the final eight episodes starting in March, correct?
That's what I've been told, yeah.
Okay. That's a fast turnaround for them. But I, by the way, want to tell you about a book that was sent to me by a guy who wrote, you must know of it, it's about the making of St. Jack.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. I mean, the guy really did a lot of work on it.
I mean, I really, it's really having a, he just reads me and he sent it to me. He lives over there, I believe, right? Doesn't he live in the Orient?
He lives in Singapore, and I don't know, he got the idea to do this book and he got somebody to pay for it, and he interviewed, you know, everybody that he could get his hands on. And it's an interesting book if you're interested in that movie. It's a little known film of mine. It's one of my better films, I think.
I think that's what the emerging consensus of these days. Hasn't that pretty much caught on? I mean, I know that it didn't get any kind of decent response or much of a decent
It got very good reviews.
Really?
It got very good reviews, yes, and won the Critics Prize in Venice. And
Well, then what am I perceiving, Peter? How am I getting it wrong? Is commercially it didn't do, is that it?
Commercially it did all right in Europe and did okay over here. I mean, it didn't cost anything. It cost about $1 million. So Roger got all his money back from Europe with one sale. But it did all right. Mm-hmm. And it's just that it didn't. The distribution in America wasn't great.
Right.
It sort of has a cult following. Mm-hmm. People like Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach, I think, and Quentin Tarantino, they're big fans of it.
I would have been. I gotta ask you this. I've heard ever since. I think I heard from Mike DeLuca or something, but at one point they wanted you to direct Warren Beatty's movie Town and Country that Buck Henry was writing. Can you give me a rundown as to why you didn't do that? Because that would have been really nice. I had
no idea. They never asked me. There was some talk about it with one of the early producers of it, but
all right.
I don't think I even read it.
Okay.
There were other pictures that I was supposed to do with Warren, like Heaven Can Wait.
Mm-hmm.
That I backed out of because I could tell Warren was going to direct it himself anyway, and I don't cotton to that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Town and Country, I never read.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you must be working on something. I mean, honestly, Peter, I really got to compliment you again. I just think that the sense of control that comes through in this Ford film is really exceptional. It's not just another respectful, dutiful documentary about a great filmmaker. It's really got that X extra factor, you know. I really...
Well, thank you. I think the factor is that I knew him, and it's kind of personal. And and I think the fact that we have these, you know, golden interviews with Wayne and Stuart Fonda and Ford himself, I think that contributes a lot to the warmth. And then the directors that I interviewed who admired him were very genuine, and, you know, they have a lot of positive and very respectful things to say. I don't know. It was a labor of love, always, because there was not a lot of money in it ever. And I think I'm glad you like it. When we screened it at Telluride, the Telluride Film Festival ran it twice, 150 people and then 450 people, and each time it played the same way, and it played like a feature. There was a lot of laughs. I mean, huge number of laughs for the first hour, and then it got quiet, and then everybody was crying at the end.
Yeah.
Grown men came out having been weeping.
Yeah.
So, I guess it worked.
I think it absolutely does work. I was just wondering about Sacred Monsters. As I was reading about it initially, do you weave? I mean, you've had so far, you've had an amazing life, Peter. Going back to the early 60s to the present, and you've really your path is woven through a lot of other lives in a really fascinating way. Do you link in your own personal life, your own recollections, the own arc of your own life in this, or is this strictly a kind of an anecdotal this person, that person type of thing? How does it work, Sacred Monsters?
Well, I take as the theme of the talk is basically my interest in how a given film reveals the personality of the director, or the similarity or dissimilarity between the persona of an actor and his real personality. And of course, it's all based on personal anecdotes, things that I saw or observed or was told. And I weave myself into it because it's all happened, it's all first person. It's not, you know, somebody told me. It's all first-person stuff. So there I am sort of passing along to Ford something that Orson said about him. Then he's him reacting to what Orson said about him in a telegram to Orson, then Orson calling me and reading it to me. So, you know, it's all woven in together. There's a section when I talk about making the last picture show and how Ford intervened and got me Ben Johnson to do the picture. And then how we shot it, and connects to something Ford said about accidents it being the best things in pictures, and Orson agreeing, and then I tell an example from the last picture show about an accident in that picture, and so on and so forth. I weave myself into it, but it's all about things that happened to me.
All right. You know, recount that for me briefly, if you would. Are you saying that Ben Johnson, having been shown the script or read it, did not want to do it for his own reasons, and he had to be kind of talked into?
Oh, yes, he turned it down several times.
Several times?
Several times.
Because of what? Did he perceive some lack of experience on your part?
Too many words.
Huh?
Hold on one second.
Go ahead.
Hold on a second.
Sure.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Okay. It's a wonderful part. It's Ben Johnson's the best thing he ever did, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, actors often don't know what's the best thing for them to do. So I complained to Ford that Ben was giving me a hard time, and it's a funny story. It's a long story. I tell it in the night. But
okay.
But Ford broke him down enough that he would come and talk to me, and then I talked him into it.
Okay.
Agreed to do it reluctantly, and then won the Oscar for it.
Do you, pretty much every director I've ever spoken to, as you ask them, do you have any favorite children? And they say, no, I don't have a favorite child. They're all my children.
Oh, well, you know, Ford used to ask, when you ask Ford what's your favorite film, he'd say the next one. And, But I have a favorite, but it's a completely personal reason. I don't say it's my best film. It just happens to be my favorite. It's They All Laughed. Probably because it's a picture I did with Audrey Hepburn. And probably because I was in a very happy state during that picture, and the picture sort of represents my own personality better than some of the others.
Hmm. 79?
Came out in 81.
Came out in 81, sorry. Well, I'm very much looking forward to seeing seeing you deliver the live show, and I think I'm going to come and see the Ford documentary on the big screen just to see.
Well, it plays differently on the big screen because the audience reaction is amazing.
Yeah. Is it going to be digitally projected, or is it on film, or how is it
shown? I think the projection will be digital.
Okay. Have you noticed how when you see films that are have not been yet transferred to film, I've gotten sort of used to the digital projection. It looks pretty damn good. I know it doesn't
look like...
I think
it looks pretty good. I don't think anybody can tell, pretty much, except us folks.
Yeah. I mean, it's
I have a problem with
it. In fact, it's almost more vivid in certain ways, more sharper and cleaner. It just, I used to think that when they were talking about how, you know, exhibition, as we have known it all these years, is basically that film is over, and I don't know how...
On the way out.
Yeah. When do you think it's going to be gone?
I don't know, you know, but it's going to be phased out. I mean, it's, unfortunately, because film is something great about film, but I think it's on its way out.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got to go in a minute.
You got to go. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, Peter,
anyway.
And I look forward to seeing you on the 9th.
Well, come over and say hello.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.